This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher on VSiN, the sports betting network.
It is our final hour of Sharp Money, live from downtown Las Vegas, Bar Canada at the D, as we welcome you back with our producer Wyatt Tomchek, Jared Smith next to me. I'm Ben Wilson. A final from Euro 2024. If you are just joining us right now, England becomes the first team in Euro history to trail in both its quarterfinal and semifinal matches and advance to the final. And that is a third 90th minute plus stoppage time, either equalize or winner for England throughout this tournament. Pretty incredible when you think about it that way.
The second we went to stoppage time, I should have bet over 2.5 at like 3-1. Because it's just at that point, you've done so much work to get back into the match. I should have taken at least a half of a unit on a goal being scored, or even England, because really at that point, England was the only team that even looked hitter-ish at that point in the match. Netherlands was just begging for extra time. I'm happy, though, because I think we have a good final. B, now I have a chance to win a really fun futures parlay.
No doubt. Well, look, I certainly would have leaned Spain in the championship match. I'm a little bit surprised, though, at the opening odds from DK here. Spain minus 165, England plus 125. I get that England has been... that is to lift the trophy. I understand that England's been playing with fire throughout this tournament, but
England's
you cannot refute what they have been able to do with their backs against the wall. Yeah. Spain, don't get me wrong, unbelievable defensive team, so well organized. We saw how they were able to really put the clamps down on France once they took a 2-1 first half lead yesterday in the first semi and have the extra day of rest. But is that really worth a difference here on the straddle of all the way up to minus 165?
No.
To me, probably not. That's
England's
a little bit rich.
Take some money here on that number. I think that comes down.
I would expect that too, as well. You're just standing pat. You have that England future. So
yeah, it's a futures parlay. I'm not touching anything. If England wins, that's great. Maybe in match, I'll do something. I always recommend this too. I think the idea of hedging is very nice and neat. I think it helps you, you know, close your eyes at night and sleep and dream about making money no matter what result happens. It's a nice proclamation, but I think the reality of it is much harder to do pre-flop. I think the ideal hedging situations are in-game, because I think that's when you have the most fluctuation in the odds, and that's when you have the chance to get a really good number that blows any hedging scenario out of the water. So it's not even a hedge, because I still need the Phillies to win the World Series in 4 months. So I'm not even making any money no matter what on I think it's Sunday, the final.
Yes.
Sunday, the final. Even if England does win and that part of the parlay cashes, I still have to wait out the Phillies. So there's no immediate urgency here. I think the better hedge to make would be let's get England across the finish line and then let's find another World Series team or two once we get to the playoffs that I like and then fire on one of those. So to me, this is I'm not saying anyone else is in the scenario. It's me. Who else has a futures parlay with England and Phillies?
Cross-sport futures parlay.
Well, the irony is Philly went to England this year to play a game or two games in London. So maybe there's a little bit of a little worldly connection there.
I like how Jared puts things together in his mind. It's very, very interesting.
I don't know if you want to know what's accurate. It's like the monkey with the clock. I know.
Well, as this market starts to get chiseled into formation over the next couple of days, we'll have a more deeper dive breakdown once we get to take it all in, so to speak, the matchup between Spain and England. But that is your matchup now that England has beaten Netherlands 2-1 there, both semis finishing 2-1 in regular time. Still to come this hour, Zach Cohen, VSiN senior editor, joins us to talk some Wimbledon and a little bit of NBA Summer League. Also, Mackenzie Brooks will get her thoughts on today's WNBA slate, which is pretty wild. Asia Wilson, 24 points, 20 rebounds as the Aces win and cover against the Seattle Storm on the road. And also, we'll break down some NFL futures here. And with that NFL discussion, Jared, we'll wrap up our NFC North right now. A few good minutes on the Minnesota Vikings, who are projected to be team number 4 based on the odds there in the NFC North. It's always an interesting kind of litmus test, though, to see where bettors go on those last place projected teams, because so often we see those teams start to, as the summer goes on, get a little bit of support and people think, you know what, this team is such a long shot, they're not getting enough credit here. Do you see the Vikings ending up in that sort of frame of mind from a betting perspective where you can actually make a case to them being much more competitive than the odds indicate right now?
I like O'Connell a lot. I like Flores a lot. I think both of those teams, both of those things come back, and you're obviously very excited about the defense, which I think was better last year. I'm not overly excited about the quarterback situation. I think J.J. McCarthy kind of showed you that at his peak, he's a game manager. At his floor, he is not even in the stratosphere of an NFL starter. So you're asking peak, week, year one. I'm getting thumbs down from my, obviously, Michigan fan, Michigan alum.
We might need to debate this later on in the day.
Oh, he doesn't like my analysis of J.J. McCarthy. You think the floor is much higher?
Oh, yes. I think J.J. McCarthy is going to be a great quarterback in the NFL.
I think 100%
bias. 100% bias.
What week does McCarthy end up being the starter?
That's a great question, too.
I mean, there are odds on week one.
Did you watch his first pitch at the Twins game?
Oh, it's like the video where J.J. was warming up outside and he missed the throw to the coach. And people are like, oh, it's a bust. Okay, guys, it's one throw. It's a warm-up throw.
I don't think... Listen, we already have enough pressure on Caleb Williams. To me, the rookie quarterback position in the NFL is the biggest learning curve. I think when you have a player like Caleb Williams, he relies on his physical tools and he can get by with more. JJ can't do that. He just can't. Like, he's not that kind of player. He needs the system to be good. He needs all the variables to be in place. I think that's asking too much of a rookie quarterback. I do. I think the same thing's going to happen to Bo Nix in Denver. I just think there's not enough physical tools there for him to overcome some of the mistakes that rookie quarterbacks make. Now, maybe I'm wrong about the physicality. Maybe he is a specimen that's going to come in and run all over the place and make plays, this, that, what. I didn't see that in college. I saw it in college from Caleb Williams. I saw it in college from Jaden Daniels. I didn't see that in college from J.J. McCarthy. In college, what I saw was a very good athlete playing in front of the best offensive line in the sport, playing next to probably two out of the three best running backs we've seen Michigan have in the last decade. It just, there's a lot of questions there, and I don't know if he's in a situation where we're going to answer them right away.
Well, the good thing with at all the rookie quarterbacks, J.J. doesn't really have the pressure to start right away.
That's true. That's a good point.
Sam Darnold will probably be the starter, and we don't know when it's going to happen. But he's not under the – like, he, for him, it's just learn as much as you can. Take the preseason games as, you know, kind of your Super Bowl games. I think it's good for him to ease into it instead of like, all right, here's the keys.
Here's my question, though. This guy is supposed to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. Minnesota traded up for him. He's a top 15 pick. Why is Sam Darnold starting the season as the starting quarterback?
Well, look how many people have started, didn't start right away. That are the greats. Aaron Rodgers, Patrick Mahomes.
All right, hold on.
It's 2024.
Hold on. Hold the phone. Aaron Rodgers was behind Brett Favre.
Okay, still. It doesn't, just because you are
not
starting.
Those are not comparable situations.
Just because you are not starting right away doesn't mean you're not going to be a good quarterback.
But what I'm saying is, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, if the expectations are so low that you can't even beat out Sam Darnold, why am I, an analyst, supposed to put any stock in you? You can't beat out Sam Darnold, who's been on like four teams in the last 4 years.
Well, here's Ghost. Yeah.
It feels like if that's the bar, and McCarthy can't overtake the Sam Darnold bar, you're expecting me as an unbiased analyst to put stock in a guy to be a good player in this league? I can't get there. I can't get there.
Well, we don't know 100% if, you know, J.J.
Well, you're
could
saying
easily.
He's not.
Well, that's what I say. It's not. He doesn't have the
He better
press.
Beat out Sam Darnold, or at else so,
we
expectations
all, we
are
all,
bare bottom.
We all know it's going to happen, but the expectation is like, you don't know.
But that's the point. I'm not 100% sure. Of all the quarterbacks in this rookie class, I'm 100% sure about Daniels and Williams starting day one. Those are the only two definites. I think you've got a interesting situation in Denver because of just the love affair that Peyton has with Nix, where I think he might get the inside track.
Odds are what, minus 400 on Nix?
I think the Minnesota situation is the most unique of them all. Atlanta Penix is not. He's not going to be the starter week one. That I'm like 99% sure about. The Minnesota situation is really a coin. It really is a coin flip, and it could blow in either direction, based off of what happens in camp. The point being, if he can't overcome Sam Darnold, I have serious questions about what the future is, at least for this season. Maybe next year is a different story, but this year, if you can't beat out Sam Darnold in camp, I don't know.
Well, Darnold's still a slight favorite there as far as the odds that have been posted to win that job. Like, end of the day, though, regardless of who is the starting quarterback, Minnesota's offense is going to be, it's a win if it's average. where this team will make its bones and will have any sort of success is on the defensive end. Okay. Because Brian Flores came in last year as a DC and took a collection of rookies and outcasts and turned that defense around into a top, it was a 13th best pass defense on an EPA per play perspective. And that's despite throwing out random rookies and undrafted free agents out there left and right. Now you've actually invested here, and even though the Vikings lose Danielle Hunter, a really good edge rusher, I'm fascinated to see what happens with this newly made defense with Flores having another year in the system where you bring in a Shaq Griffin, you invest a first-round pick after McCarthy,
I like
on a Dallas
a
Turner, guys like Blake Cashman and Jonathan Grenard who have been around in the league or more veteran presences. Yep. That, to me, is the big wild card for Minnesota because regardless of quarterback, Jared, I feel like it's a pretty safe bet to say that Minnesota isn't going to be winging the ball up and down the field on
Van
offense.
Van Ginkle's such a great hire.
Andrew
such
Van
a
Hinkle.
Great signing from them. Coming from Miami, knows Flores' scheme when they were together down there. I think there's a little bit of a, I'll call it slight optimism with Minnesota. But when you have that big of a question at quarterback, it's hard for me to be really optimistic. Like, because right now they're being priced like they're the worst team in this division, and they might not be. I think there's a chance that they're the third worst team. I just, if McCarthy can't beat out Darnold in camp, I mean, you're not putting your faith in Sam Darnold to take this team to the promised land.
It's also a team, too, that's really bizarre. When 2 years ago, they were the luck box team of the NFL as far as wins in one-score games. Last year, they regressed all the way past the mean, and they went all the way south. I mean, it was like going from, you know, Mankato to why I can insert other random Minnesota town in it. They went all the way down past St. Paul and even further south. Anyway, bizarre team to figure out Minnesota in 2024. Zach Cohen, he joins us next to talk some Wimbledon right after this.
This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher on VSIN, the sports betting network.
The NFL preseason kicks off in less than 1 month, and lucky for you, the VSiN experts have been hard at work this offseason putting together our new NFL betting guide. Become a VSiN Pro subscriber today and access this invaluable guide, and for a limited time, we are offering an unbeatable deal. Get a full year of VSiN Pro for just $199 instead of the usual $240 annual price, and as a special bonus, we'll add an extra month for free. That's 13 months of access to everything VSiN offers, including daily best bets, round-the-clock video content, premium analysis, exclusive betting splits, data, and all our special edition betting guides to keep you informed and winning throughout the year. Don't miss out on our all-new NFL betting guide and this fantastic offer. Head over to vsin.com/subscribe and use promo code SHARP to get 13 months of VSiN Pro for just $199 and gain instant access to our NFL betting guide. You know who's a big part of the NFL betting guide, Jared Smith?
Zachary Cohen.
That is correct. You got it.
Ding, 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 ding.
I set you up for it. We are underway here in our afternoon slate of baseball, by the way. Second game of a double dip between the Twins and the Sox. We'll preview the rest of the baseball slate here with Jared in about a half hour. But right now, a little bit more pressing. It's Wimbledon going on right now. We're down to the semifinals, both on the men's and the ladies' side. Zach Cohen joins us on our progressive guest line right now. Betting on X is where you follow him. Outstanding write-ups every single day throughout the tournament here is our VSiN senior editor. As we welcome in Zach, first off, Zach, as you know, we're American tennis fans here. We're all rooting for the American guys. Was this last 3 days not just the perfect encapsulation of Taylor Fritz, the highs and the lows? You come back from two sets down to Sasha Zverev, and then you just totally take a deuce in the fifth set today against Lorenzo Musetti. Like, come on, man. I'm rooting so hard for the guy, and he just can't get over the hump.
It was the perfect encapsulation of American tennis in general between him and Tommy. I thought Tommy, you know, came out hot against Alcaraz. I really thought that he was going to have a chance of winning that match, but his legs just died in those third and fourth sets. He's a completely different player towards the end of that match than he did in the first. And I do think that Taylor, that was really, really tough. I mean, that's got to be the best chance you're going to see for an American to get to a semifinal for quite some time. It was, you know, a match he was a big favorite in, maybe a little bit too favorite. I mean, Musetti is a really good player. Like, there's no shame in losing to Lorenzo Musetti, but maybe doing it on grass as a big favorite, as a big server, definitely stings a little bit.
You know, the one thing, too, that jumped out watching the Alcaraz-Tommy Paul match, like you were talking about, Zach, I mean, Alcaraz was all over the place on his serve, the first set and a half. Like, he couldn't buy a first serve. He was winning, like, 55% of his first serve points only because of that attrition, and you saw how the fatigue really kicked in for Paul, and he loses, does Alcaraz ultimately comfortably advance. Are you a little bit surprised to see the, you know, the gap as high as and as wide as it is for the Alcaraz and Daniil Medvedev first semifinal on the top half of the draw, when you consider that Alcaraz gets so aggressively priced here? But, you know, Medvedev, while he has kind of taken a back seat to the top echelon of guys recently in the market, has still really proven himself as he takes out Jannik Sinner, albeit an injured Jannik Sinner there in the quarterfinal the other day.
I definitely am. I think that we've been really quick to point out that, you know, Sinner, Alcaraz, and Djokovic are the new big three, maybe even Djokovic fading a little bit, but it really does a disservice to Medvedev, who has won a Grand Slam, is still in the prime of his career. I don't rate him that much lower than I do those top three guys. So when I see really lopsided spreads with Medvedev against those players, I'm pretty quick to jump on the game spread. I haven't written that match up, but that's probably the way I'm going to go with it. I do think, like you said, Alcaraz's serve was all over the place against Paul. He went down a quick break in that second set against Tommy. Tommy was not able to to serve it out. I just think that Medvedev is a little bit more reliable with the ball in his racket. I think he's going to present some real problems for Alcaraz with the flatness of his shots. And I do think that Alcaraz, the shot selection is still a really big problem. You hear all these greats say that he's going to be his best version of himself when he really simplifies things. I think that's very true. I think you're seeing that in 2024. I actually think he was a lot better last year than he is this year, just because I think he goes for too much. I think Medvedev plays a straightforward game, is a really good strategist out there on the court. I think he'll come in there with some sound techniques to get Alcaraz on his back feet. The way he did against Sinner, I thought that was really impressive.
Zachary, on the women's side, it looks like we've got a couple of pretty decent favorites heading into the semifinals. Let's start with Italy's Jasmine Paolini. She was just in the French final, which was exciting. About a $2 favorite against Croatia's Dana Vekic. Anything interesting there?
I ended up going with Vekic to win a set. I think that Paolini probably ends up winning this match. There's really nobody hotter than her right now. She played so well at the French Open. I think a lot of people were concerned about how her game would translate over to grass, but I guess that defense, it works anywhere. She hits a really heavy forehand for a player that is smaller in size. She's really good at the net. But at the same time, Vekic has had a lot of success on grass in her career. So she might not be a player that's been top 10 in the past. Maybe not a player that you think of when it comes to overwhelming talent. But she hits really hard from the baseline. She's good at the net. She's a good server. She's played some really impressive matches in this tournament. She beat Paula Badosa in a three-set match that really could have gone either way, where she really just kind of came through in the clutch at the end. I just think that this is a really big spot for her, one that she's been waiting for a very long time. So I'd be surprised if she went out without, putting up a fight a little bit.
It's amazing, too, just the low center of gravity for Paolini. It seems like she absorbs so much of the pace at Wimbledon. And the way she dusted Emma Navarro as a dog, Zach, I think we were all very surprised to see in that quarterfinal. It's amazing.
Young, by the way.
Yeah. Hey, what are you going to do? It happens from time to time. Zach Cohen with us here, breaking down the Wimbledon semis right now. Also, Dana Vekic, by the way, Jared, her coach is the great Pam Shriver. And Dana Vekic was, it's funny how things come full circle. Remember all those years ago, Zach, James Blake yelling at Pam Shriver to shut up when she was talking too loud while commentating his match? Dana Vekic yells at Pam Shriver to shut up, who's her own coach.
There you go.
Pam Shriver, she just talks too much, I guess, Zach, at Wimbledon. But yeah, to make a semi in your 43rd career Grand Slam, it does speak right to the A, variance at Wimbledon, and B, the way the women's game now is as wide open as it ever has been.
Yep, definitely. By the way, Dana Vekic, a member of one of tennis's power couples, dating Borna Coric.
Oh, there you go.
There's a few of them that sneak up on you.
That will sneak up on you from time to time. To me, we were talking yesterday, Zach, I felt like it was really the last moment to buy on Elena Rybakina in the futures market, where she was still a plus price going into her match today. Where I sort of felt like the match against Elena Svitolina, you could potentially call a de facto final. Rybakina has been so good on serve, wins that match 2 and 3 here. Now she's about -190 to win it all. About a $5 favorite against Barbora Krejcikova, who is a very crafty player and has been a Grand Slam champion in the past, albeit on clay. Do you see any way in which Rybakina finds some trouble in that semifinal?
I actually do. I went with Krejcikova to win a set at +125. I just think that if you look at their head-to-head history, it's brief. They've played two matches, but Krejcikova has won both of those matches. Neither of them were on grass, but they were on indoor hard courts, another very fast surface. So I think that she's shown that she can kind of hold up against that Rybakina serve in the past. And I do think, she's really crafty. Like, she changes the angles of shots. She changes the height of shots. She has a really good slice. That could get to a player like Rybakina. And we've seen her come through against two power players in a row with wins over Danielle Collins and Yelena Ostapenko. Rybakina is a little bit different. She's much bigger. She has a little bit more variety, but it is another power player. I think that Krejcikova has shown that her game gives those types of players trouble. And I just think that Krejcikova, it's really easy to forget that she's a former Grand Slam champion herself. She won the French Open in 2021. She's a player that has been a top five player in the world before. I think she's kind of starting to recapture that form. She's had a lot of bad luck in the health department over the last few years, but when she's healthy, she's dangerous. So I thought that seeing a plus money on just to win a, you know, just to win a set for a player that's 2-0 against her opponent, that was pretty hard to pass up, especially with Rybakina having, you know, struggled against Paolini the last time she was a big favorite in a match late in the tournament at the French Open.
Zachary, let's spin this thing forward. Do you have a final prediction for either the men or the women? Do we have any value left in the futures market, or do you think it's just kind of chalk city as we get this thing to the finals over the weekend?
I think it's probably chalk. I mean, like, I do have Krejcikova to win that set. I think that Rybakina still probably wins the tournament. On the men's side, it's really hard to say. I mean, you're getting Djokovic has 3 days of rest now to play Musetti, who just came off a 5-set match. I would be really shocked if we don't see Djokovic in the final. And I do think that he would have a pretty good shot against Alcaraz if we don't see Alcaraz, you know, tightening things up with the serve, which is just kind of crazy from where we were a few weeks ago. I wrote an article saying that you should have bet Djokovic at plus 400 odds before I saw the draw. Then he ended up playing absolutely nobody.
It's crazy.
Looks healthy after having that knee surgery. He's just had a lot of luck go his way. And just, I thought he played the best match of the tournament against Holger Rune last match. So now I do think that there's a chance that Djokovic does win. So yeah, it's a really been a really weird tournament.
Hey, man, beauty of the draw. That's how it can get so wacky, these tennis tournaments. Djokovic, a $6 favorite at open against Lorenzo Musetti. Alcaraz about -325 there against Medvedev. That's the upset pick I would have. I'm with you, Zach.
Medvedev.
I will be looking at the games, the plus games bet there.
The Slim Reaper.
On Medi, yes, there in the Thursday semi. And then Krejcikova and Paolini each favorites. I should say Rybakina and Paolini each favorites in their semifinals tomorrow. Zach, as we wrap up here, any strategies, tips for the bettors looking to get involved in NBA Summer League, something that you have always been a great resource for diving deep in as it gets underway here on Friday?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you want to go for like teams that have players that have a little bit of experience. I don't think you want to go with the rookie-heavy teams. I think those guys are out there trying to showcase themselves for their front offices and coaching staffs. So I don't think that they're really looking to win games. So I think you want to have some experience. I think you want to have a point guard that makes good decisions. You don't want guards that are just out there looking to score 25 points. I will say, you know, as before I get off here, I think that the Orlando Magic might have the best team in the summer league. And I think you get a really good price on them to win at 17-1. I just think that Anthony Black coming back as a second year player in summer league as a point guard that is going to be looking to make plays and try to earn a spot in that Magic rotation by making good decisions for others. And you got Jarrett Culver, a player that have had a lot of success in the G League last year. Then a bunch of shooters and a good center in Jay Huff, a shot blocker that can make threes.
Great stuff, man. Giving out summer league futures. That's how we love it.
Abracadabra.
Betting on X. Thanks, Zach.
Thanks, guys.
Magic 17-1 to win the Summer League. When we come back, we'll talk some WNBA and NFL with Mackenzie Brooks from CBS Sports.
This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher on VSIN, the sports betting network.
Back on Sharp Money, where we can remind you, now is a great time to check out our new look website at vsin.com. I'm looking at it right now. And Zach Cohen, who was just on with us, has his full Wimbledon breakdowns for the semifinals. Women play tomorrow, men coming up on Friday. You can also check out Adam Burke's daily MLB write-ups, along with other best bets, betting splits, exclusive articles, odds by state betting tools, and betting guides. It is optimized for mobile, all available at vsin.com. Speaking of the MLB card, Jared Smith, we have yet to break down your run first inning.
Did hit one of them yesterday. The other game got rained out. So hopefully we'll carry it over today.
All right. You got some action. You're 1-0.
I have two today.
You have two today.
All
right. Let's ride into today. We'll talk about that in our final segment. Some breaking news as well from the U.S. Soccer Federation that should have been breaking about 6 days ago, but we'll talk about that as well in our final segment. For now, though, let's talk first a little bit of WNBA and then continue our NFL futures discussion we were having earlier on in the show as we go out to our progressive guest line. It's a true pleasure to welcome her in. Mackenzie Brooks, betting analyst for CBS Sports, joins us right now. Thanks so much, Mackenzie, for taking a few minutes. And WNBA-wise, I'm just fascinated as someone who is following it very very closely like you are, and very interested too in the betting markets. We've seen such an explosion here from the ratings perspective. Today was a crazy slate of games. Asia Wilson, 24 points, 20 rebounds. Caitlin Clark, 29 points in a loss, and another double-double for Angel Reese. What have been your biggest takeaways, especially for, you know, newer bettors who are looking to get involved with this ratings boom here, based on what you've seen now nearly the first half of the season?
Yeah, well, it's amazing. I mean, even compared to last summer, I followed it pretty heavily when no one else really was. And to see just the books get sharper, you know, so much sharper now this summer than they were last summer has certainly been interesting. I think it's still a good time to get involved this quote unquote early in the season, because even now, still, if you go past the Caitlin Clarks, the Angel Reese's, if you go past, you know, maybe the top three or four girls right now in a matchup, you can start to find some really good value on some of these props. When you go to the bench, when you go to some of the role players and you get nitty gritty, there's still a lot of value to be had. Certainly not the same value as last summer. The books are certainly a lot sharper now, but it is interesting because you can still find some of those nooks and crannies to find some value.
I agree 100%, especially when you look at just what the prop market has become. The more options you have, yep, the more product that is out there, it's harder and harder to get all those numbers right. You do your homework, which McKenzie certainly does.
Scheduling spots still exist.
Yes.
Still flying commercial, still playing four games in five nights.
Yeah. Percent. There are absolutely situations available. All right, let's hop over to the NFL, because we had camp day in the WNBA. Everything's already over with. I think the offensive rookie of the year market's always intriguing. We have had, there's been a little bit of a wide receiver run over the last few years. You had Ja'Marr Chase, you had Garrett Wilson, but for the most part, it's been a quarterback heavy award. You have two quarterbacks at the top of the market this year. I think the gap between Williams and Daniels is a little bit too wide. And then you get Marvin Harrison kind of sitting there in the third spot there waiting to pounce. How do you see this offensive rookie of the year market playing out in the NFL?
I agree. I think that, you know, that gap is a little too wide as well. I'm big on Jaden Daniels in a multitude of ways, one of them being offensive rookie of the year. And it's a lot of the same logic I had fighting for him in his campaign for the Heisman. OK, this is not any shade at Caleb Williams. He is so great at what he does. But this award is about exceeding the expectations that are set for you. And our expectations for Caleb Williams are so high that it is almost impossible for him to go out there this season and do more than we already anticipated him to do. So that's just really what it comes down to. Even looking at their win totals, Washington Commanders at 6.5, you have the Bears at 8.5. I think Caleb Williams really would have to go 10-7 and have like 28 passing touchdowns for us to say, wow, he exceeded what we thought he was going to do. So that is big for me. Again, Daniels as well just poses as that run threat that I don't think Caleb Williams meets him there in the same aspect.
Caleb Williams, your favorite, plus 135 right now, as McKenzie Brooks joins us right now at Ken's Brooks Bets here on our Progressive Guest Line, talking some NFL futures, especially on the awards markets for 2024. I think a lot of bettors, McKenzie, really struggle with where do you even start? We lost McKenzie.
We unfortunately lost McKenzie. Apologize.
I was about to ask the best question in VSiN history.
That was going to be an awesome question, too. I will say this. It looks like we might be getting her back in a second, though. To me, the offensive rookie of the year stuff is, you look at a market like that, and you just say, how can a guy that is so unproven be that much of a favorite?
Yeah.
And it goes back to expectation versus reality. Like, the reality is you have rookie quarterbacks. There's upside, there's downside. But the pricing says Caleb's a shoo-in here. And I don't see that being the case.
We do have McKenzie back. McKenzie, I was in the middle of asking the best question in VC history. No way you can ever push back against that, but nobody will ever know what the question is. Oh, wait, no, they will right now. I'll ask it to you again. The defensive rookie of the year market. Great to have you back. I feel like most bettors look at that market and they go, how the hell am I supposed to break this thing down? This is impossible. We're just throwing darts. It takes a lot of research and education on role within these individual systems, which you have done a lot of. Can you help the casual bettors out there who have no idea of really where to start on what you should look at there for the defensive rookie of the year?
Yeah, there's a really strong trend. The last seven winners, there's two parts of this equation. You have to have 10 plus sacks, and you're typically coming from a defense that ranked 27th or worse in the season prior, which makes sense because you need to have a high ceiling in order to get to this award. So Leiatu Latu fits this perfectly. He's on the Colts defense, who ranked 27th last year. A lot of upside. You need upside to win this award. I think he can get the 10 plus sacks. And I think the Colts defense going from 27th to really improving any mark will show that he can get this award. You look at someone like Dallas Turner, I think he can get the 10 plus sacks. I think he will be so great for that Vikings team, but they already ranked 13th in defensive rating last year. So there's not as much upside for him to show that he's improving this defense. So I think Latu is the best one with the best value right now to show that he has two parts of that equation.
31 of the last 34 winners in this market have been first round picks. So you can, and Cooper DeJean, who is getting a lot of love there in Philly, I think you can throw him out, and the rest of it, you're right, McKenzie, it's sacks, it's the ability to get after the passer. To me, that's the name of the game. I think the Sauce Gardner year is kind of an outlier. Unless someone has an unbelievable year in the secondary position, it feels like rush end, defensive line is where I would skew here. The stat leader markets are always intriguing to me, especially running backs, especially because it's, you know, basically a defunct position these days. But most rushing yards, listen, there's some big numbers out there for some of these guys. What was your initial handicap in this market? Is it everybody but Christian McCaffrey, or do we kind of go in a chalkier direction?
I'm looking for some value here, not an insane amount of value, but relative to the Christian McCaffreys and the Jonathan Taylors. I think Derrick Henry at around 19-1, 20-1, you can get him right now. I think he has a ton of potential because you talk about yards before contact, none of which he was getting in Tennessee. When your quarterbacks are Tannehill or Levis and they don't pose to be any type of run threat, everybody knows when you're getting the ball. But the quarterback or the running back room in Baltimore, it's a different story. They get those yards before contact because defenses know that Lamar could also be a threat himself. So he had 4.2 yards per carry in Tennessee. I think once you start to add those yards before contact that you get in Baltimore, that becomes closer to 5. And I'm talking about the other running backs, but they're basically all gone. Think about Gus Edwards is gone. Gordon's gone. J.K. Dobbins is gone. Keaton Mitchell is still there, but he's hurt for the foreseeable future. So that's almost 280 carries that need to be redistributed somewhere else. And I can't imagine Lamar is taking all of them. So I can't imagine a world where Derrick Henry isn't a workhorse this season.
And McKenzie, to your point, you know, DraftKings is down to 10-1 now on Henry. Clearly there has been a thought of, okay, with a fresh start and a new look and not the worst offensive line in the league, there could be some success there, but still shop around because, as McKenzie points out, you can find that Henry number at a little bit longer. We'll close with the most receiving yards market as well, because yeah, similar to on the rushing yardage market, there is a good amount of variety and volatility that goes on here. You can catch some and pick off some longer shot prices. Where did you see your eye start to gravitate as you looked at this market?
Going younger here, I'm going with Puka Nacua, 14-1. I think he's a good sleeper here. He was fourth in the league as a late round rookie, okay? So now he's going to up his percentage here for this team. He had 35% of the receiving yards last year. I understand Cooper Kupp is always an issue, but I'm not that concerned with him because even when Kupp was playing, Nacua was still getting the yards he needed. And Kupp is always guaranteed to miss a few games. I don't really think this is a 15-plus. I don't think 15-plus game seasons are left in Kupp's career. So I think it's a good spot for him. As long as this team stays as a top 10 passing offense, get around 4,000 yards, and Nacua is getting, you know, from 36 now up to 38% of those, I think he should be in that 1,500 range, which is where you start to see these awards come to fruition. So if he can get to 1,500, which I absolutely think he can, I think he could get this award.
Maybe some bias towards some people who didn't vote for Puka Nacua to win Rookie of the Year last year. Get him a little bit of extra love because I thought he was very worthy of winning that award, but of course you can't overcome what CJ Stroud and the Texans did. Just incredible stuff. McKenzie, where are you with the rest of your football handicapping process? Are you at the point yet where you feel comfortable win totals, division odds, or are you just kind of getting into the player props market at this off-season stage?
I think there's a few win totals I do like just based on strength of schedule, the Saints being one of them. Similar to Houston for me last year, it's not about the team's talent, it's just about the schedule that they have, and the Saints have the same really easy schedule that they had last year when they got 9 wins. I look at teams like the Chiefs, who at this point I don't think really care about the regular season. I could see them going under 11.5 wins just because I don't think Andy Reid is trying to show all of his cards in the regular season. So it's really about the mentality of some of these teams. A few totals I like, a few division winners I like, maybe long shots, but I'm liking the prop market right now. I'm liking the prop market for these rookies. Jaden Daniels too, 16.5 passing touchdowns, I think is a great number.
It's a good one as well. McKenzie Brooks, awesome insights for us here on Sharp Money. Give her a follow at Ken's Brooks Bets, outstanding betting analyst for CBS Sports. Great to catch up with you, McKenzie. Really appreciate the time.
Thanks, guys.
If Dennis Allen could just like stay out of his own way, because I feel like I bet the Saints over every year.
Dennis Allen.
Stop sticking.
Derek Carr, throw him in that mix.
Yeah, that too. When we come back, Jared's best bets for Major League Baseball, and we'll talk about the breaking news in U.S. soccer when we come back on Sharp Money.
This This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher on VSIN, the sports betting network.
Make this NFL season your best ever with our all-new VSIN NFL betting guide. The guide is packed with everything you need to bet the NFL smarter, including in-depth previews of all 32 teams, new quarterback and head coach breakdowns, Super Bowl predictions, a prop betting guide, plus best futures bets from the VSIN experts, including MVP, Rookie of the Year, and Coach of the Year awards. Whether you're a seasoned bettor or just getting started, our NFL betting guide is your ticket to smarter, more informed bets. Visit VSIN.com/guide to get your copy of our all-new NFL betting guide today. As we're back for the final time here from downtown Las Vegas, Bar Canada, the D patrons starting to file in with afternoon baseball almost here with Jared Smith, who's we're going to talk about his baseball card for the rest of the day. Wyatt Tomczyk, our producer.
In the audience too.
You're what? You're seeing?
Am I seeing that correctly over there?
You're seeing what?
That is correct. That is Mike Palm,
yeah.
VP of
Mike Palm is here.
The boss in the building.
There we go. Good to see
baseball.
Mike Palm.
Always great to see Mike.
Mike's got a front row seat to the action.
I was going
to
say, he's one of the patrons right now.
One of the patrons. with Wyatt Tomczyk, our producer. Big thanks to Sean McComb on audio, Larry Meir, Matt Hicks, technical directors for the show today. Mike Palm, we got to say hi to him after the show.
I was going to say, clearly he wants to be part of. Maybe we should invite him on.
I think he wants to give his thoughts. Mike's a big soccer bettor.
Yeah,
and Greg Berhalter finally out as U.S. men's national team head coach. We thought this decision would come immediately. I saw a story come out yesterday that it was kind of like one of those rumbling stories saying basically the Men's Soccer Federation was just trying to buy time until people started talking about the whole Berhalter out movement. And I think they realized, Jared, that movement was not going to quiet down until Berhalter was actually out, hence the Berhalter out hashtag. So he is finally gone. And a good riddance to a guy who you had very sketchy family connections in the Federation already, had not really done anything at any sort of high level in club soccer to begin with, tried to basically blackball Gio Reyna for the national team over a very weird, petty, off-the-field issue, and ultimately his team's never achieved close to the type of success that the U.S. men's national team with the talent on its roster certainly could have. This is the only decision that they could have made, Jared, to get him out here before this run-up to the 2026 World Cup commences in the North America.
I thought you laid it out very well. I don't have a whole lot to add to the Berhalter analysis of the situation, but the timing of when they released the news I think is very intriguing. They waited till after the Fox post-game show ended so there could be no immediate reaction from the top pundits on the networks that have been very critical of Team USA throughout this entire process. I know it's the Euro, not the Copa, that was being played today, but Fox shares the coverage. It's a lot of the analysts doing both. Obviously, Alexi Lalas, to me, has been the most vocal of the analysts on the major networks against what the U.S. men's national team has done during this process. So I'm more of an analyst of the situation. I think you did a good job of the micro. There's no place for what he did in the future of the men's national team. To me, with the World Cup being here in 2 years, you have to get this right. This cannot, and I feel like I'm a broken record, right? We have the, the video of all, what are we doing, right? The viral quote, what was that, Twellman? That's how I feel every single time the Team U.S. is in a major spot. Like, it's just, what are we doing? And you now have 2 years for a World Cup to be played on your home soil to get this right. And I hope they do, because I'm not a soccer guy. I don't know. I just bet the scores because I think they're fun. But let's be honest, this was a very unfortunate series of events that led to the firing.
You would have really painted toward the network burial-ism as far as when they released it. Had they released it like tomorrow morning at noon Eastern, when Copa America and Euro will be off after today until Sunday with the championship matches, that would have been really egregious. At least they got it out there, but that will, I'm sure, be talked
about. I'm not surprised they waited till after they went off the air.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
100%. That was a calculated move.
Very calculated. We do have the Copa America match tonight, 8 Eastern. Uruguay, Colombia from Charlotte with a date with Argentina in the Copa America final. Meanwhile, Euro 2024, Spain opens as about a $1.70 favorite to lift the trophy over England your final there for Sunday. In the meantime, though, Jared, we've got a full baseball card already. Yeah. The second game of a double dip underway in Chicago. White Sox again up. Martin Maldonado, who had him hitting a homer on your
what
bingo
was
card
the
today?
Odds of the White Sox sweeping this doubleheader today? Oh. Probably was a 10 to 5, 7, 7, 8, 9 to 1, somewhere in that range. Well, I'm sure
the cash is about $1.40 dogs earlier today. They're about plus 185, plus 190.
Yeah, that's probably at least 6 to 1.
So you're at a pretty good payout right there.
Six
I will calculate
for them
that
to sweep
for you.
A doubleheader. That would have been my guess. I'll give you my two nerfies for today. So yesterday we went 1-0-1 because of the rain out in, I believe it was, yeah, Chicago.
Plus 655, by the way, if you did the two-leg parlay.
No, it was close on the odds there. The irony is I went back on the nerfie in that same game this morning, which hit, even though it was basically a roller coaster because Eric Fetty had bases loaded, nobody out in the top of the first, and figured out a way to get through the nerfie. But that's ancient history. Today's ancient. Nerfie, ancient history. Basically, you know, we're in Egypt territory, you know, when they're combing the desert for the 40 days and 40 nights, 40 years, whatever the story was. I don't know. I'm Jewish. I should know that, but I don't.
You've had some good lines today, by the way. What did you call me beforehand?
I don't know. I'm on like my eighth show this week already, yeah. And it's only Wednesday. I'm just getting through the week.
Well, I liked Ben, remember? He was
dullard.
Like, that's what it was probably was, yeah.
I was a dullard saying that segment or saying that joke just now because that was not even close to the joke that I was trying to make. We're going with the Guardians Tigers nerfy here. How about this? If I was going to ask you guys a question and I said, which starting pitcher in Major League Baseball has made at least 15 starts and is not allowed to run in the first inning this year, who would be your guess?
15 starts.
At least 15 starts.
At least 15 starts.
And has not, so 15 straight, 16 straight, at least 15 straight starts without giving up a run in the first inning. Who would be the pitcher? First pitchers come to mind.
My natural thought, just based on the year he has had and how good he's been early on in starts, would be Tanner Houck amidst the
You would
the
be
top.
Wrong.
And I would be wrong.
I'm going to go bias here, Reynaldo Lopez for the Atlanta Braves.
You're right that he's undefeated to the nerfy, but he hasn't had as many starts
not
as this
many
guy.
Darn.
Reese Olson.
Really?
17-0 to the nerfy this year. The dude that's is crazy. The nerfy pitcher of the year.
And he's not even any good. That's what's wild.
Listen. I don't make the numbers.
I know. That's
them.
The thing. That's, it's what's, crazy. That's what's crazy is it's not even that good of a pitcher.
The underlying metrics in the first inning for him are fantastic. His whip is sub one. He's got a 32% K rate in the first inning this year. Go figure. Reese Olson, the best nerfy pitcher in baseball. He starts for Detroit tonight. Bybee on the other side, the nerfy rate hasn't been good, 12-6, but the underlying metrics very good. Sub three xFIP, sub one whip. 35% K rate in the first inning. I think he's gotten a little unlucky in the first inning. Gets a Tigers lineup tonight that, let's be honest, is below average. Obviously, I'm more concerned about the Cleveland side of the lineup because they do have Ramirez and one of the Naylor brothers probably hitting in the top four there. But again, Reese Olson, Superman to the nerfy, 17-0 this year. So I'll give you Guards Tigers. It's a juicy one. It's like minus, I got like minus 130. Probably have to pay probably higher than that now. The other one's really juicy. Maybe you put these two together in a parlay. You get a two-team nerfy parlay, get you plus money. But we'll go right back to the well, Blue Jays Giants. I mean, listen, this first five total is like 3.5 juice to the over, but still really low. Chris Bassett, 15-3 nerfy record this year, 7-1 on the road. I always look at the road nerfy because that's the closer, right? The closer of the nerfy is always the road pitcher. I want to feel really confident heading into it. On the other side, I mean, I feel really good about Logan Webb. Not as good of a nerfy record as I would have expected a guy like Webb's numbers to be. 12-7 nerfy record, but look at his last five starts. ERA sub three has been fantastic. And we get to face the Blue Jays, the same team that went 29 straight games without scoring a run in the first inning, which is almost statistically impossible. They have failed to score a run in 9 of their last 10 games. Again, chilly night in San Fran. You get that marine layer. We saw it last night. Kikuchi was unbelievable. I think Logan Webb and Bassett have enough to get me through the first here. So how about you parlay those together? Again, a very juiced nerfies here. Blue Jays, Giants, and Tigers, Guards. That's what happens when you bet these late, but I still feel confident both are going to hit.
You would also think when you don't score a first inning run in 29 straight games, the tax becomes pretty ridiculous.
But they're still the Blue Jays might be the most disappointing team in baseball.
I agree. Yeah. Now that the Astros have turned it around, yeah. The Astros have become a favorite to win the AL West, as crazy as that is. Yeah. They're still behind the Mariners in the standings, but I mean, Houston was definitely your leader in the clubhouse. That award definitely now goes to, Jared, I still actually make the Cubs more disappointing than Toronto.
Sure. Although just you do have a guy who might win division. Rookie of the Year on the team, which right. is ironic. I don't think Shota's going to win it, but he could win it.
Strength of the division for Toronto, you can always point to and say, well, the competition was always going to be great.
Fair.
I mean, Chicago, you were favored. You know, you had all this investment. You bring in Craig Counsell. You're dealing with, I mean, the team that's leading that division by four games, Milwaukee, had a win total that was not very high. I mean, it was barely above 500 this year.
Yeah.
And yet that was a very popular under bet. A bunch of other rebuilding teams like the Pirates, the Reds, like there's no reason based on the Cubs roster they should not be, I mean, at the very least, you should not be last in that division in 10 games out.
No, and I think Pittsburgh will come back down a little bit and we'll see what happens. I mean, I think the biggest question in the second half of the season for the National League Central, I think it's twofold. It's who adds more in the arms race between Milwaukee and St. Louis. I think both of those teams will be very active. Milwaukee's already added. I think Scherzer might be up next for St. Louis. And will the Pirates shut down Skeens? Those are the two questions I have
in
the second
half. Yeah, second half. Pirates Brewers tonight, part of the MLB card there. That does it for us. Outstanding show as always, Jared.
Appreciate you, bud.
Great hanging with you. For Wyatt Tomchek, our producer. For Jared Smith, I'm Ben Wilson. This is another edition of Sharp Money in the Books. Up next, VSiN Prime Time at Circa with Tim Murray and Jonathan Von Tobel.